You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. Coming up, bald eagles and other wildlife face lead exposure in part because of ammunition and fishing gear. We'll talk to an outdoor journalist about the issue coming up.
First, people in northern Wisconsin are still experiencing a variety of effects from July's violent windstorm.
The massive amount of downed trees has been impacting the timber industry and increasing potential for wildfires.
Not to mention debris that's being cleared and could become more hazardous with winter weather.
Journalist Larry Parnas has been covering this story as part of a fellowship at Marquette University. His piece on the topic appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
He's normally with Berkshire Eagle in Massachusetts. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks very much. Great to be with you.
Put this into context for us. Remind us of the size and scope of this storm and the damage it caused.
Well, it came across the northern part of the state, and it's remarkable to me how urban centers just have remained unaware of what transpired up there. The core of the storm came through about 60 miles of area, about 10 miles wide. In all, it was roughly a 360 square mile area affected by the storm, and the worst damage in the national forest itself was an area bigger than the city of Milwaukee, nearly 100 square miles.
And it sounds like it was hit or miss. I mean, certainly most of the area was damaged in some way, but we're talking really close distance between an area that is just leveled and things that an area that seems kind of untouched.
Yeah, the storm was kind of like that. It was a two storm systems came together, a rogue supercell and a line of thunderstorms. And they just joined and powered up. These are systems that reach up many thousands of feet. And it created conditions that sent these massive downdrafts called macro bursts. They hit the ground. They move in the direction of the storm, which is proceeding to the southeast. And they just kind of plowed away randomly at areas in that part of the state, which are largely forested. There's some farm country up there, too. So it was really haphazard where it hit, but the devastation when it hit was could be 100% in certain areas. The National Forest Service, which oversees the big Schwamigan-Nicolet National Forest, they count about 10,000 acres that were 100% damage.
And I think of all the trees, being blown over, straight-line winds are being taken out, but you describe them as like a playing cards fanned out, the way some of the trees just dropped in different directions. What does that do for, cleanup strategies and trying to figure out how to kind of put the forest back together?
Oh, there's really no putting it back together. It's just, even some pretty hardworking Forest Service people who refer to themselves as can-do type people, look at this as a 10-year effort, and even at their best, they don't have the resources to right now to even account for the full extent of it, and going forward, how to deal with it. In some cases, it'll be only in winter when wetlands and swamps freeze, where they could go in and see fully what's happened on the ground. It's a matter now of salvage. So there were about a dozen active Forest Service timber contracts in the works, and those have all been renegotiated and have turned, in some cases, from selective cuts into clear cuts. And even, Keely, many of the trees that were still standing are considered lost because they're twisted, and if they're leaning more than 10 degrees, the Forest Service will ask if they come down.
And yet, although you're talking about wood that is not usable or sellable, still we have this now glut of wood that could go onto the market. But because we have an oversupply, that's affecting prices, right?
It is. And the market, I'm told, wasn't so great even before the storms came through in July. It was July 19 and 20, Friday night, and then again Saturday morning. So the wood that's been damaged has a very short shelf life, particularly the softwoods. There's not only the twisting damage of the fiber, but there's staining from fungi. So it becomes pulpwood, and that's a much lesser value. But the question you raise of, is there even a market for this? I think most of this wood, and the Forest Service could probably supply some better numbers than they had even 2 weeks ago when I spent some time with them. This wood is just on the ground as fuel now, and so that raises concerns once the leaves come off fully and in the spring when before the leaves come back and the ground dries. There's a real increased threat of wildfire and forest fire danger.
Larry Parnas of the Berkshire Eagle in Massachusetts is examining forest health and forest management issues during a 9-month O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. And we're talking about recovery from a terrible windstorm earlier this year in northern Wisconsin. You mentioned fire danger. You also mentioned it's going to be 10 years potentially before some of this is back in order. But Larry, temperatures are dropping. We saw southern Wisconsin see its first snowfall. What are the concerns in these areas as winter weather is coming?
Well, they were very much aware of this when I was visiting up in the North Country. You know, the snow load is going to bring down more trees. So, you know, even 3 months after these two big windstorms, there were, daily command meetings about how to clear the rights of way on roads, because it's certain that snow is going to bring down more trees. Trees are going to fall across travel lanes. There still could be more people hurt from this storm. It's kind of just laying in wait. And that's something that has been a priority. And so work is going on in all of the counties across the affected area through road crews to get in there and try to clear out the edges of the travel lanes.
Right. So we have a lot of travel lanes that have been cleared, but you're talking about piles of debris just on the side of the road that could, take on snow and ice and then be jostled and pose a danger?
Well, really more the trees that are within the right-of-way, so that if they fell, that they would affect travel. When you drive around up there, it's pretty remarkable. In normal forest and timber harvesting practices, wood is piled and it's priced and all kind of factored into contracts deep within the forest. So the public doesn't really see the transaction. They see lumber trucks on the roads, but they don't see stacks of wood. And because of the storm and because of the fact, at least on the national forest properties, the Forest Service couldn't get in and really recalculate how to price newly rewritten contracts. They just have allowed, under terms provided under the Farm Bill, they could tell timber companies, just go in and use these GPS coordinates. Consider that your cutting area. Know that trees that are leaning more than 10% can come down and get in there and start salvaging. Hmm. And the work is much slower because of the density of the fallen jackstrawed trees. But when they come out, they're piled along the roadsides in decks, they're called, and they do this pricing system called deck scaling. So it's almost as if they're displaying their goods to the whole world, and in an unusual way, the public can see that this wood awaits the market sitting on the side of the road.
Yeah, certainly this story continues. Larry, thanks for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure being with you.
That's Larry Parnas of the Berkshire Eagle. He's covering forest health and management topics as part of a fellowship at Marquette University. And we've been talking about the lasting impacts on forest land in northern Wisconsin after a violent windstorm this summer.
Coming up, lead poisoning is linked to the death of a bald eagle found by the Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua. We'll talk more about the lead in hunting and where the conversation around it could be going. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin and states around the country are working to pass harsher penalties for people who trespass on and damage oil and gas pipelines. We'll learn more about these laws and how they fit into First Amendment protections.
Right now, the Northwoods Wildlife Center in Minocqua recently posted on Facebook about a bald eagle they treated after finding it lying face down on the ground.
Testing revealed a high toxic level of lead in its system. The eagle later died.
The center said exposure to lead from ammunition was likely a factor. Eagles are scavengers, and they've been exposed to lead ammunition in deer carcasses.
The question of lead in firearm rounds and fishing tackle has been around for a while. Patrick Durkin is president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association and outdoor writer and editor for several nationwide websites and magazines. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, we see this case of a particular bald eagle. Is this a common issue, wildlife being exposed to lead in the wild?
I guess you could say it's fairly common because, you know, you go back in the literature, the research, when we've been looking at these kind of cases since at least the 1990s, and it's probably happening before then too. But, you know, like when you have any, you know, there's one of those good news things where we have more bald eagles now, but unfortunately they do find gut piles left behind from gun hunting for deer season. And once in a while they find out particularly, in the gut pile that's left behind, you know, bullet fragments that they take in while they're eating I hate to use gut pile over and over again, but sure. Basically it's, you know, it's the lungs, the heart, the liver, those things primarily, but also, you know, anything else that's in that pile. And there are fragments in there. And once it gets into the system and gets broken down and into the blood system, it does usually makes them very sick or it kills them.
Let's talk about the use of lead in ammunition. For people who aren't out hunting themselves, Pat, how common is the use of lead shot?
Well, in bullets, you know, for use for deer hunting, it's fairly common. I think it's like about 90% of bullets now used for deer hunting contain lead. And then there's different components. So there's, you know, like I use copper bullets. You know, that's it's a solid copper round that doesn't have any lead inside, so it tends to hold together pretty well. But there are also lead-based bullets that have a what's called a bonded core around them that they don't break apart as much as the less expensive lead-based round that typically is used for deer hunting, and that one's less expensive. And that's always what kind of comes down to in these discussions is sometimes, you know, people resist using the more expensive ammunition because it is more expensive.
And I've heard when people talk about banning lead ammunition, which we can talk about in a bit, one objection is at least some hunters think that the copper ammunition you talked about might not be as effective, might actually be less humane because it might just injure deer, for example, and not kill them.
I don't buy that. I've been shooting it for at least 20 years, not every year, but I've shot quite a few deer with copper ammo. And the stuff they're making now, especially in recent years, is getting really good. It has really good penetration. And one advantage of it is that you don't have to use quite as heavy of a bullet, so you don't have as much recoil when you shoot some of the modern copper. So I guess I disagree with that. I just don't think they'd have much real solid evidence to back that up.
I know, Pat, there's been talk in the past about trying to ban lead ammunition for hunting in Wisconsin. I think Minnesota had worked on that. There was very briefly a ban on federal lands in hunting at the end of the Obama administration, and that was turned around under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the arguments of actual bans on lead in ammunition?
Well, the thing that I guess, you know, we've had a long time ban on waterfowl hunting with lead shot because, you know, lead shot falls in the bottom of the lakes and ponds, and there it gets picked up by everything from swans to loons to ducks and geese. And so that's been banned for, gosh, going on close to 40 years now. But where you have more lead out there is, you know, still being used fairly commonly for hunting, you know, like rabbits, pheasants, upland game. And then in deer hunting, like I said earlier, a lot of lead-based bullets from rifle rounds to shotgun rounds. But it's really a mix now, and it's not easy to always come up with the perfect solution for these things.
It occurs to me if lead bullets are breaking up on contact with an animal you're hunting and presumably eating, is there a worry for risks to human health from hunting with lead?
Yeah, they have had some. There was a real interesting case about 13 years ago where a guy out in North Dakota claimed that he was finding lead fragments in like 60% of the packages he was testing. But then when Wisconsin looked into it and other states started looking into it, typically they found that there were lead fragments in about, you know, 4% to 8% of some of the packages of ground venison they examined. But so there's always that slim possibility. But then you start weighing all the other factors in society, like, you know, in Wisconsin, we're well aware of, you know, the problem with the lead pipes in our water mains and those kind of issues. So it's, again, one of these things that's so nuanced to get into the whole thing and figure out what should we be attacking first and regulating first? That's why I guess I'm more inclined to keep talking about these things, let hunters know there are alternatives that are fairly affordable, and you don't have to worry about having, having these intentional cases where you have something get poisoned through not really aware of it.
Talking to Patrick Durkin, syndicated newspaper columnist, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, looking at lead in hunting and fishing, how it can affect wildlife in Wisconsin. Pat, I was less familiar. I've heard about the debate over lead in ammunition for a long time. Also, lead involved in fishing. Where does that get into the picture?
Yeah, that's been an issue, I think, as long as we've had lead arguments, whether it's hunting or fishing. And with fishing, you have all sorts of different size weights. In split shots are real common, little weight for taking your bait down. And then how familiar people are with the fishing terminology, but lead-based jigs for walleye fishing, for everything from crappies to walleye. So you have all sorts of different things made out of lead, but they're all alternatives. But again, it's when these cost things were. A lot of times stores will offer some of these non-toxic alternatives, but it's not always easy to find. And so you have that. And I know in my case recently, I've been kind of more of a fisherman where I don't use sinkers. I'm more of a troller and using strictly metals that aren't toxic. But again, there's a time for everything. And I guess my thought is we got to just let people know there are alternatives, and that when they go looking for them, the more people looking for them, the more they'll find them, more they'll stock them in stores.
Well, now I imagine if I'm fishing with lures and other gear made out of any kind of metal, I'm hoping to bring it back home with me. Is the concern that ones made out of lead end up for one reason or another getting left behind?
Yeah. Well, what happens, fishing lines break. Mm-hmm. You snag the bottom and your jig or your tackle at the bottom of the line fault, breaks off and lays in the bottom. And then things like loons can come along and take it up, or swans can take it up. There's all these different diving ducks sometimes go down and grab stuff. So that there is that potential for a loss that way when you have, birds, waterfowl out there picking up these things off the bottom.
Do you see over time, Pat, anecdotally, or I don't know if we have industry numbers, but do you see hunters being interested in fighting and fishers being interested in finding alternatives to lead?
Yeah. For me, the thing I see that's interesting, you see more hunters talking about the copper bullets now. I mean, it wasn't always a controversial thing. I remember when I first shot copper back in the 90s, it was just kind of a cool new development in ammunition. And then as time went on, it became more of a discussion over the toxicity issues. But at first, it wasn't really that wasn't what we were talking about. But now, in recent years, as these bullets have gotten more popular and the cost isn't quite as high as it used to be, I do hear more people talking about now. And there's even some people even call them hippie bullets, because folks like me that think, well, they're a good thing for the environment, and hunters like to tease each other about it. So at least I figure, even if hunters talk about it sometimes disparagingly, I figure at least they're talking about it. At least they're thinking about the fact there are alternatives, and maybe they end up trying them and finding out that, like I've done, that they work really well. They're accurate, they're hard hitting, and they're a very consistent round.
You've introduced me to the phrase hippie bullets, Pat. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
I want to take a few minutes now to switch gears. Hunting season, deer season, of course, just around the corner. You and I have talked about CWD, chronic wasting disease in deer, a lot over the last bunch of years. What are the latest parts of that story you're watching for in Wisconsin's deer herd?
Well, this year we have, it's, I guess my frustration, Rob, these days is I think we have cases now, like up in Oneida County and over in Eau Claire County, where I wish we were looking a little more closely and more aggressively to make sure we know the extent of the problem in those two areas. Because we've had this chronic area down in southwestern Wisconsin, no pun intended, where it's been getting worse and worse and worse, and especially in Dane County, Iowa County, Sauk County, and Richland County. But we also have some outliers up in Adams County, Oneida County, and Eau Claire. And we have still, as a state, do not really get out there and test these areas with a real systematic surveillance through sharp shooting or through hunters and making sure we really know the extent of the problem in those areas. You know, we just had in our case show up in Oneida County last week. So I guess that's the thing I've been kind of harping on this year is that, you know, we have this in our plan on how best to do this, but we really aren't doing it.
And you'd been critical in the past of the Walker administration and their approach to CWD. Do you see much different under Governor Evers?
Unfortunately, not really. I have to say that that's been, a disappointment this first year of the Evers administration. There really hasn't been a big change that way. We've seen very little leadership as far as making us think that things will be different this year. And in fact, just about a month ago, the DNR backed off. And initially we had this idea where hunters in the Eau Claire County area in six townships going to have mandatory testing where every deer shot in those townships would have to have their deer tested. But then the Natural Resources Board came in and kind of overruled that and put it back to a voluntary basis. And I guess my point is that this is a case where a citizens committee came up with that recommendation. It was basically a hunter-based committee that made the recommendation. The DNR approved it, and then a month later, the Natural Resources Board pressured the DNR and made them back off.
We'll leave it there for now. Pat, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Patrick Durkin, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. We talked to him today about lead exposure from game animals, how it can affect other wildlife and people, and we checked in with the latest on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer herds.
Coming up, a law being considered in a state Senate committee would create harsher penalties for people convicted of trespassing on or damaging oil pipelines. We'll learn more in a moment. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent's guest says there's a long history of religion on the left side of the American political spectrum. Meet the author of Spiritual Socialism. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a bunch of states around the country have either passed or are considering laws that would create harsh penalties for people who trespass on or cause damage to oil and gas pipelines.
In Wisconsin, a state Senate committee is considering expanding a 2015 law that makes it a felony in cases involving utility providers. The change switches the language from utility to energy, so it includes natural gas, renewable energy, and oil and gas pipelines.
Later, we'll look at some of the criticisms surrounding these laws and how they could affect free speech rights.
First, we take a look at the states that have passed these laws and why. Jennifer DeLohi is a reporter for Bloomberg News covering energy and the environment. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Where do we first see these laws bubbling up in states across the nation?
Well, you know, the trend really started in oil and gas heavy states. Oklahoma was kind of played a leading role where you saw state lawmakers advance this idea of, you know, protecting pipelines and oil wells and other energy infrastructure. But it's spread pretty quickly. So, you know, Oklahoma has passed. It was, of course, the first to get in this direction. But Louisiana, Texas have all followed suit. North Dakota and South Dakota, where, of course, we've seen protests against the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access pipelines, also have put laws on the books. So it's really spread quite a ways from the traditional oil patch at this point. And of course, state lawmakers are broadening these crimes to include not just oil infrastructure, but other energy or infrastructure facilities.
Yeah, you mentioned Dakota Access, and I've got South Dakota roots. So looking back at those environmental protests, Standing Rock was one of the biggest demonstrations we've seen recently. How much did that protest impact the oil and gas industry or how state legislatures are thinking about regulating it?
Absolutely. It has inspired a lot of this activity. And it really has given, a visual demonstration and to all of these efforts by energy companies and utility companies to get these laws put on the books at state levels. They can very vividly point to, the protests that we saw unfold in South Dakota. I mean, I'm biased because I cover energy, but, many people saw videos of that on social media. They saw videos of the confrontations with police. And for people who, lawmakers in Wisconsin and other states that are advancing these measures, that's a potent reminder of how tense and heated those protests can become. Of course, it's not just happening in South Dakota. There are protests against energy infrastructure happening across the nation. Louisiana actually enacted its law as kayak activists. Protesters in kayaks were criticizing and protesting against one project. So we're seeing it unfold in many different places.
And Wisconsin wants to expand an existing law for felonies to change the language from utility to energy to include those oil and gas pipelines. They face some pushback here in northern Wisconsin. How have these states capitalized on laws that are already in the books to maybe even tighten regulations?
Oh, that's an interesting question. In some of these cases, the states were writing the laws from whole cloth. They spitting them out from the very beginning. Wisconsin is one of a few that have gone back to earlier statutes and looked to expand them. On some level, these are all dealing with, protests. These are all dealing with vandalism type crimes that are already on the books. That's one of the criticisms you hear from opponents of these laws, that essentially they're taking crimes that already exist and heaping on more penalties and in a way that could really chill free speech.
Jennifer, you report on environmental and energy, the energy industry. What does this movement, these laws, especially in the last few months, signal to you about the role that energy companies play in public policy?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I mean, energy companies have been playing a big role in public policy for a long, long time, but perhaps it is becoming more and more visible. These measures are really being driven by chemical companies, by energy companies, by refiners, who are very active at the state level. I mean, of course, they're active. I'm based in D.C. They're active at the federal level, too, but they're seeing real progress working in state houses, working with state legislatures to get laws on the books. We're seeing them really try to affect state policy, and they're doing it through coordinated networks that advance model legislation for state lawmakers. Obviously, there's a good deal of funding support for state lawmakers that may contribute to some lawmakers' receptiveness to these proposals. But no question, they're active and they're becoming more so.
Although states aren't just passing these laws and implementing them without any sort of backlash, we know that there are lawsuits. We know that not all states have stuck with what they've passed originally. So what pushback are we seeing once states move forward with these regulations?
You're right. There's been a tremendous reaction to these and a tremendous legal reaction. Several of these measures are being challenged in federal court. But most recently, South Dakota just days ago agreed in a legal settlement with the ACLU to back away from its recently passed law. That came only after a federal district judge, issued a preliminary injunction blocking enforcement of their law that would have allowed the state to go after individuals or groups for encouraging protests where acts of violence occur. What's interesting is that settlement, I mean, that's really the first pullback from a state. It's a really significant win for opponents of these laws. The judge in that case warned about the chilling effect of these laws and had a really interesting comment in his opinion, saying that, wondering what would have happened had these kind of riot-boosting statutes been applied to civil rights protests in Birmingham, Alabama. And that's really the kind of sentiment that you're hearing opponents use as they challenge these laws once they've gone into force.
Jennifer, thanks for breaking it down for us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Delohy is a reporter for Bloomberg News covering energy and the environment. And we've been talking about harsher penalties for protesters who trespass on or damage infrastructure like oil and gas pipelines.
Now, we pick up that point about free speech and protest concerns that these laws have raised, specifically issues related to that lawsuit we were just talking about.
Eric Casper is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
We just talked with Jennifer DeLohi of Bloomberg about these laws. And what's your immediate takeaway when we hear about the steps that states are taking to curtail trespassing around these pipelines?
Well, I think there are kind of two different competing interests here in terms of the ways we could think about it. One way of looking at this and the way that the supporters of the legislation are looking at it is that the First Amendment doesn't protect you from doing things on other people's private property without their consent. And, that's something we can go into in more detail here as we go along. But, of course, on the other side is this question of curtailing free speech rights, particularly with a lack of clarity when one might be trespassing on private property, and in particular with questions about the harshness of the penalties that if we're dealing with moving something into a felony classification, that can have potentially a really chilling effect on expression.
I mean, there are penalties for protesting or trespassing. They've been around for years. So why is it now that these laws might not be sufficient for some lawmakers?
Well, you're right. The state statutes have a trespass to land restriction. That trespass to land is a Class B forfeiture, which means it's a maximum forfeiture of $1,000. There's also a misdemeanor statute about causing property damage without consent, where one could face potentially up to 9 months of jail time. But it was in 2015 that the legislature put on the book this statute prohibiting criminal trespass to an energy provider's property. The thinking behind that is that if someone potentially go on to the property of a utility company, and if they're looking to commit acts of terrorism, they could cause some sort of infrastructure damage that would have a crippling effect on a community or on a region. And so that's the original thinking behind that legislation in 2015. And so this legislation would be expanding that to include not just what's already in the statute, but also looking at gas, oil, petroleum, water, and renewable fuel companies and their property that would also be included.
We're talking with Eric Casper, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And you can join the conversation about potentially increasing restrictions for protesters in pipeline areas. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, lawmakers who support the expansion of these laws say that it's a way to protect workers and the people protesting. And this week on The Morning Show, Democratic State Representative Jason Fields of Milwaukee had this to say about the bill.
When we looked at this issue, it was how do we protect the workers and how do we protect individuals who do want to protest, who do want to exercise their right to free speech? And this was a way to do it and target bad actors. What happens is a lot of people get a slap on the wrist, and next thing you know, they're back to doing the same things that they did before. Case in point, in the city of Milwaukee, we've had to deal with that. And so for us, it was, let's make sure we're protecting individuals and what we call the Worker Safety and Energy Security Act by, again, increasing the penalty so we deter negative behavior.
That was Democratic State Representative Jason Fields. Eric, do these laws actually deter people the way that Representative Fields hopes?
Well, it's an interesting inquiry here to look at this because, on the one hand, there's quite a bit of social science data that shows that within certain limitations, if penalties are increased, that can certainly have a deterrent effect. However, there's a real question then about what's the right point that you would have to reach to have the deterrent effect that not only potentially the maximum deterrent effect, but the deterrent effect that's appropriate. And so if you're looking at trespass as a forfeiture action, which is how it's typically going to be handled now, that forfeiture, which could be hundreds of dollars or upwards of $1,000, or potentially it could be, it certainly has some deterrent effect. And there are a lot of people who would not want to pay a forfeiture along those lines. Or you could look at what happens in a lot of states around the country where there is it's a misdemeanor offense where one could potentially face some jail time for it. But if we're looking at the deterrent effect to go down the road of making it a felony, that in of itself is a very high penalty, and it carries with it quite a number of things, you know, not just the term, a lengthier term of imprisonment and extended supervision, but also the potentiality of a fine that's attached to that. It can have long-lasting impacts in terms of on one's job prospects or housing, education. There are other rights that are affected in terms of one's right to vote if they're a felon, or one's ability to legally possess a firearm. There's social stigma that gets attached to it. So certainly there can be a greater deterrent effect when we increase penalties. But the question we always have to ask is, what is the proper deterrent effect given the behavior that you're trying to avoid here?
We're talking to Eric Casper of UW-Eau Claire about laws being passed in states that would create harsher penalties for people who trespass on or damage oil and gas pipelines and the potential legal challenges to these laws.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these laws that increase those penalties? Do you think states, including Wisconsin, should pass laws to protect property here? Do you worry about the free speech rights of protesters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we continue our conversation about laws being considered around the country and in Wisconsin that create harsher penalties for protesters who damage pipelines or trespass around them. Our guest is Eric Casper, Associate Professor of Political Science at the UW-Eau Claire.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support tougher state laws when it comes to these kind of protests around pipelines, or do you worry about their impacts on free speech? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Let's take a call now. Phyllis from Dunn is joining us here. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I work with landowners along Enbridge's Line 61 corridor who do not want a fifth pipeline put on their land. And they're very opposed to this felony trespass bill because they believe it could be used on them, that they could become felons by trespassing on their own land, which they have been forced to make available to Enbridge's four existing pipelines. So imagine if they looked out and saw Enbridge's contractors cutting down some trees that they had been promised would be spared, and this happens all the time. Say they rush out and shout angrily at the workers to stop it. The workers might say, "We're scared. We're calling the police." And the police come and they say, "You are on land that is leased by the energy company. Therefore, that falls under this law. We can arrest you now and charge you with a felony." And hopefully, in the end, a judge would say that's unconstitutional. I mean, the South Dakota law has already been thrown out. But in the meantime, they could be injured in the course of being arrested, traumatized. They could spend a whole lot of money on their defense and so on. And it's really not fair to do that to people. It's also for people who don't want these pipelines, which are carrying fossil fuels, and we have to make a transition to get away from fossil fuels. And if they would step on, having a demonstration or something and step across the line onto there, they could become felons and go to prison for 6 years. And
Phyllis, thanks so much for that call. Eric Casper, want to give you a chance to join in a more nuanced look at what this might mean for First Amendment rights on your own property.
Yeah, the law that's being proposed to amend here states that whoever intentionally enters an energy provider property without lawful authority and without the consent of the energy provider that owns, leases, or operates the property is guilty of a Class H felony. And so I think there are a couple of things that are of note there. The first is that, if you have a situation where there's been an easement or a lease or something along those lines, then it would certainly apply. And so there may be questions about, if we don't know exactly where the landowner's property ends and the property being utilized by the pipeline begins, that can definitely run us into some problems. And again, the chilling effect that's potentially there, if you don't know where the line is, you may want to stay a ways away from it. The other thing is that, in some of the testimony here on the bill did come down to questions of, the physical safety of the employees or of workers. And I think that's certainly something that needs to be taken into account. But the law here that is proposed to be amended doesn't get into the issues of property damage or issues of disorderly conduct or if someone is engaging in some form of violence. It talks about that if one is intentionally on that property without the consent of the energy provider. So simply being there and protesting if you are trespassing could trigger this law coming into play.
Let's go to Matt from Lodi now. Matt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. I see this very similar to railroad infrastructure. I think everybody that has grown up in the United States has walked along the railroad tracks in some way, shape, or form in some place or another. And it's technically private property, and the railroad considers that a trespass. And I see this type of a law and this type of infrastructure the same way. Unless there's barbed wire, similar to like an airport or an electrical substation, which we would consider a high security facility, this is over the top beyond what we should be doing for trespass.
Matt, thanks so much for that call. And Eric, I wonder then, when Matt's drawing this analogy with railroads, you know, if it is a concern that it wouldn't be people necessarily involved in protests, but it could be someone just in the area who would fall victim to this and, you know, wind up with a felony at the end. I mean, is that a concern or is there more context to it?
Well, I can tell you as far as what would be added into the statutes here, I mean, it would say that, you know, if you are there for certain purposes, for instance, if one were on this property because they're monitoring compliance with public or if they're there as a part of union organizing or picketing when there's a labor dispute, or if they are exercising protected free speech or free assembly rights, that would be, you know, that the law would say that those are activities that would be protected. But again, if we're not exactly sure where the line is, that's where some of the problems can come in. I mean, another analogy that I would draw where, I mean, the analogy, I think the lines are pretty clear, is there's a state Supreme Court decision called State versus Horn that was from 1987, where it dealt with some abortion protesters who actually went inside of a clinic and refused to leave and wanted to protest there. And the state Supreme Court there was very clear that, I mean, as an issue of private property rights for the clinic, you don't have a right to protest inside the clinic, right? But certainly there are rights of protesters if you're outside on public property, if you're in a traditional public forum, First Amendment rights would apply. And so, you know, that's the sort of thing that we want to make sure we guard that line, right? That private property rights are protected, but at the same time that's not to the point where protesters have no idea where they can and can't go, and so they just don't protest at all, and you're effectively chilling that speech, and that's the risk with if the actual where you can and can't go isn't exactly clear.
So at what point does constitutional law step in to halt state laws that may be infringing upon our First Amendment rights?
Well, you know, if this law were to pass, I'm quite sure that there would be some type of challenge to it, either some type of facial challenge, or if someone were arrested for allegedly violating it, that would certainly get it into a criminal case in court. And, you know, the argument there from the defense would very clearly be along the lines of that this is creating an unconstitutional chilling effect because of the fact that it's not clear where one can and can't be, that the penalties themselves are so harsh that they're causing a chilling effect. Of course, on the other side, if the government or if it's a criminal case, the prosecution is going to argue that this is about protecting property rights and it's about ensuring public safety and about ensuring the safety of the energy supply. And so then, you know, at that point, you know, a judge is going to have to issue a ruling on this in terms of do they find that this has crossed the line to violate the First Amendment or not.
Thank you so much for your time, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Casper is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And we've been talking about laws proposed and even passed nationwide that could impact how people protest pipelines and construction.
More on this Friday at 7 on the morning show. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at the efforts to create a Lyme disease vaccine. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a national security staffer and Army officer testified before a congressional committee on key presidential phone call as House Democrats get ready for a procedural vote on impeachment. Get the latest in our weekly roundup of national politics.
And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, get the inside scoop on college financial aid, how it works, who gets it, and what that FAFSA form is all about anyway. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, what do congressional hearings and floor testimonies have in common? Our guest says they're boring and fail to get people interested in Congress. We'll share some ideas to spur engagement and interest. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.